Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Barry Schwartz, joined by Ernest Wong. We got a lot to get to today. We're going to talk about CCL Industries and its monster quarter, as well as the Netflix dropping of its bid and I guess Warner Brothers being won by Paramount. We'll talk about the implications for Netflix and why the stock of Netflix rocketed up about, 20% in the last few weeks. We'll also get into talking a little bit about the month of February and the results that our clients had. But before we get into that, let's get into this. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to us on YouTube, on Apple, and on Spotify. If you have any interest, of course, in Baskin Wealth Services, please check out our website at baskinwealth.com. Please follow me and Ernest on Twitter for great advice and great tweets. Once in a while, we make some pretty good ones.
Well, technically not advice.
Not advice. But if you're looking for advice for your portfolio, you want to become a client or you're a client and you have questions about what we're doing, please reach out. It's been a busy month for us in terms of February. The most trades we've made in a month in a long time. We were pretty silent in terms of trading activity in 2025, but 2026 has been very, very big for us. One of the trades, we sold a company that we had less conviction in to really double down on a company that we think has long-term prospects that are much better. We also bought three new names in the portfolio and did a couple trimmings and some sales. We also trimmed back some larger positions in our portfolio. It has nothing to do with the fact that we lost confidence in those names. It's just that the valuation on some of our long-term winners has gone maybe a little bit ahead of itself in the short term, and we saw some opportunities in this market. With the pullback, of course, in AI-related names and software-related names, so there was certainly a lot of interesting opportunities as 2026 continues.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. The reason that we're not publicly disclosing the names that we bought right now is more because we're still working into the positions, still trying to figure out the portfolio management and which clients' portfolios make sense with
Absolutely.
It. But we will talk about them in due time.
That's right. And if any clients have seen some of the trading activity in their portfolio, please reach out to your portfolio manager. We'd love to discuss the rationale and reasons. And we're excited to share a few new names with you over the next few weeks as Ernest said, as we fill out our positions and we get fully invested in those new names.
But that is the point of public markets, which is that when stocks are volatile in public markets, not like privates or alternatives where, you know, it's kind of a hypothetical value that a person comes up with.
Yeah.
But public stocks go up and down. And I think that as investors should take advantage of these kinds of opportunities to always be re-evaluating whether they like what they have, whether there's something that's more attractive.
Mm-hmm. We don't outsource our research to anybody. We don't outsource our research to the stock market. We outsource our research to ourselves and really make investments based on fundamentals. And what the interesting thing that happened, we've talked about this on the podcast the last few months, is a lot of our companies are reporting great results. We're going to share that in a blog that we'll post on our website very shortly. A lot of them raised dividends, double digits. Like, you know, I'm thinking like Taiwan Semiconductor raised a dividend 40%. First Service raises dividend double digits, Moody's double digits, Brookfield, yet some of their stock prices have done nothing. And so Ernest and I are always attracted to great businesses where there's a temporary narrative worry or the stock hasn't done anything lately, but it's clear that the fundamentals are doing great.
And that's a pretty consistent theme around the companies that we own where the businesses are doing well. Mm-hmm. It's not that there's some company issue and you're hoping that things get better. The businesses are actually performing well.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of the stock market not being as enthusiastic about them as we would like.
I think there was one company out of 30 plus that we owned last year that didn't, or maybe two, that didn't report results that we thought were up to snuff, so to speak. But that being said, both companies are in a very cyclical industry. Right. This year, we only have one company that it's on our watch list, so to speak. But we're certainly going to talk about that because this company started a share buyback, and it's something that it rarely does share buybacks unless it really thinks the stock is cheap and has excellent a track record with when it announces monster share buybacks.
Right.
So let's. What do you want to start with first? Netflix?
Sure.
Yeah, so Netflix stock, as everybody knows, has been under massive pressure the last few months, making the bid to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery for, I think they wanted to pay, what, $27.75 a share?
Yeah, so I think this is an interesting, that is an interesting point of contention around the why Netflix is no longer buying Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. The price.
Yeah. So, and of course, there was a pullback in the general market, a pullback for maybe some higher quality names. And then there was a stupid worry that, well, everybody can make these silly AI videos. No question you'll be watching that instead of watching Netflix shows. That to us makes no sense, but it is what it is. No question people are digesting content in a different way. And that's always evolving. The younger generation, of course, likes shorter form videos. But, you know, at the same time, I have teenagers and they're catching up on all these wonderful shows that their parents love to watch. I have my youngest son watching Sopranos now, and he's catching up on Breaking Bad.
Right.
And he wants to catch up on Game of Thrones, even though he likes to scroll through Instagram and Discourse and TikTok and whatever and look at little videos for 2 seconds.
Yeah, so I think we were on the record for saying that we thought it was a great deal for Netflix, that we wanted them to be able to buy Warner Brothers because we thought that they had a good opportunity to really generate a strong financial return from capturing the international growth
that
Warner had.
And Warner, for those who don't know what we're talking about, owns HBO, and HBO has some really high quality content, intellectual property, whether it's Game of Thrones or Harry Potter or DC comics like Batman and Superman, I think, right?
Yep.
And more, and they can milk some of these franchises. In the meantime, they have like some amazing shows that may have been on the air 10, 20, 30 years ago that are still do well, right? Whether people look at Sopranos or Game of Thrones again or The Wire or what have you. So great content. I think Netflix could have milked it tremendously. I think Netflix could have gotten a ton of more international subscribers by using its distribution network. But it is what it is. One thing Netflix said is we're not going to overpay. What was the line that the company said?
So I think the thing that really surprised me was the speed with which Netflix said that they were out of the process, because so the way it happened was that.
But they said Warner Brothers is a nice to have at a good price, not a must have at a bad price.
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah. But basically, Paramount had been kind of dithering around. And so Netflix gave them a 7-day window with which they could go to the Warner board and say and come up with their best and final offer.
Well, Netflix essentially raised its bid by getting rid of the share component, correct?
It was the same price.
It was the same price, okay. But more cash.
Right. Okay. But so Paramount came back and they offered $31 for the entire company. Mm-hmm. And so Warner spent a few days thinking about it, and then they said, yeah, we think that this is the superior offer to what to Netflix.
Well, it sure is. They're offering 31 versus Netflix offering $27.75 and not taking the cable networks.
Right.
Okay.
And almost immediately, Netflix said they're out. They're not even going to counter the offer. They're not going to match it. Like they're just totally out of the process.
And wasn't that on the same day that Netflix's co-CEO was talking to Congress, or?
So he went to the White House.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So I think that on social media, I think there's a lot of kind of buzz about how this was a genius move by Netflix, how they got a competitor to kind of burden themselves with a lot of debt to buy this asset while they get $2.8 billion as well as the rights to probably continue licensing a lot of the Paramount and HBO shows. The conspiracy side of me thinks that Netflix had been meeting with regulators, including the US president. And I think that he was feeling that there was some change in the ability for them to be able to complete this deal. And so he was looking for an opportunity to get out of the deal. And it just so happened that
Paramount raises bid.
Paramount raises bid and were willing to give Netflix a break fee, they walk out of this looking great.
Yeah. So here we are a few months later. Netflix stock is, I think, hit a high of about $130, $140 a share. Fell pretty much in half in a very quick period of time to the mid-70 range. Now close to $100 a share again. So still well under its all-time high price. Part of that has to do with, there's a conspiracy theory that Netflix probably wanted to sandbag his guidance a little bit too, as it's heading to make this acquisition. It doesn't want to tell the antitrust that it's making a ton of money and we're going to, it's going to even improve our monopoly. But so what I want to learn today, what I want our audience to learn today is Netflix now better positioned and how will Paramount be hurt by acquiring Warner Brothers, and how can Netflix take advantage of it, and will it be beneficial for Netflix's stock?
Well, I don't think it really changes anything for Netflix fundamentally because they've been running their business all along the process.
Yeah.
Like they signed a new distribution deal with Sony, right? So they've been working on stuff all along, even while working on this Warner bid. I think the $2.8 billion is kind of nice to have, but Netflix is such a profitable company that it doesn't really meaningfully change anything that they could or couldn't
Netflix
do anyways.
Netflix market cap is about $400 billion. Yeah. So $2.8 billion, it's a nice, no one's going to say no to that, but it's not a life-changing amount of money. They're not going to distribute that back out to shareholders as a special dividend.
Right.
They may use some of that to improve their business or buy back stock, but it's $2.8 billion more money than it had a few months ago.
I think more importantly, there's two things. Number one is that they're still going to be able to license, or maybe even more so now, they're going to have the opportunity to license a lot of Paramount and Warner's content after they combine together. And the reason for that is because Paramount's going to have $72 billion of debt. They just had an investor event this morning about the deal. And they're targeting $10 billion of free cash flow by 2030.
Yeah.
And $72 billion of net debt. So
by 2030 or today.
By today, right?
Yeah.
But when closing.
So they will pay down some debt over the next few years, but it's going to be a tough slog. Yeah. And this, of course, is based on a steady state scenario where they don't lose subscribers or something changes with the world. Yeah.
And especially given the fact that most of the profit in Paramount Warner today is coming from linear networks.
Yeah.
So these are declining, melting ice cube type businesses.
Paramount owns CBS, owns a number of other cable networks, right? Yeah, so the cable networks, people still pay for them, generating good free cash flow, but we all know what's going to happen in the future. Very few people are going to pay for cable unless it's sports. And as Netflix and Apple and grow bigger, they'll probably acquire more sports, not leaving cable with less content.
And so I think it's pretty obvious that they're going to need to syndicate some of their content out to companies like Netflix to be able to pay down all the debt that they have.
That's right.
So Netflix gets the content in the end, they get a break fee, and they don't have to come up with all the debt that they're raising.
Does Paramount so one of the keys that you were excited about was Netflix's ability to distribute HBO internationally to its hundreds of millions of subs. I think Paramount doesn't have hundreds of millions of subs and probably nothing serious internationally. So they'll probably still have to ask Netflix to put their shows on Netflix distribution, and that's free money for Netflix.
Right. I think there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical about why Paramount plus Warner is going to be meaningfully different than any other major media merger in the past. just a few years ago, Warner itself merged with Discovery.
Yeah.
And that again, worked, the thesis at the time was that it was, they were getting scale and that they had, it was going to be a challenger to Netflix.
Yeah.
And as we see, like, this is kind of what happens when you merge two legacy companies together.
The Netflix story has no warts on it. It has no cable networks attached to it that are losing customers. The last quarter, tremendous growth. It's guiding, for, I think, for what, 20% profit growth in 2026. Even better going forward. I see there, like you said, still all systems go. Lots of sporting events, new ones that have been announced, some old guys boxing, but people seem to love that stuff. So where do you think Netflix reinvests in its business going forward? Clearly, it's not going to get, this was the highest value IP available that's not already owned by Disney. So that's off the table for now. Does Netflix lean more into video games? Does it lean more into sports as a result? Or just continuing doing what it's doing? The other thing I also read is that Netflix ad load is still much lower than a lot of its competitors. So there's more upside there.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't think it changes anything for Netflix's strategy fundamentally. Mm. I think there might be opportunities for them to get some of the talent that is cut as a result of Warner or Paramount.
It's a good insight, yeah.
Because they're going to, the whole plan for Paramount Warner is that they're going to generate cost synergies, mm-hmm. right, to kind of make the combined entities worth more. But where do you get cost synergies? From firing people, right? So I think they'll have a lot of opportunities with that. One thing that Ted Sarandos, the CEO of Netflix, had said was that they were looking at, like, one of the benefits of this process was he personally had met a lot of theater owners in around the country, mm-hmm. and like kind of shared the fact that Netflix is not hostile to theaters and that they might look for ways to work together mm-hmm. going forward. So maybe we'll see more things from that.
Yeah, I mean, the theater going, it's an experience, right? It's experiential. You can go with your friends, your date, your kids, get the food. I mean, it's a night out. And I don't know about you, Ernest, but there's not a lot of movies I can watch anymore. I look at what's nominated for the Oscars, and I'm not interested in any one of them. And I think 2025 was a pretty bad year for movies all together, right? And so I don't know, maybe we need more sequels to Barbie and Oppenheimer to make the theater business going. But it's clear to anyone who's paying attention that the theater business is going down the toilets. We're not seeing, we're just seeing big spending on, coming back to the same old franchises over and over again. And on the plus side, of course, I think Netflix will see huge benefits from AI, right? In terms of making product and licensing content. And
yeah, so I think with AI, if you look through the past of advances, technological advances in mm-hmm. creating content, what usually happens is that it allows the creator to make better shows and movies, mm-hmm. right? So if you think back to the original Disney cartoons, right, they were drawn by hand.
Yeah.
And once they started being able to use computers to do that, they didn't just use the computers to draw faster.
Yeah.
They used the computers to make more like pretty animations that are better stories and better visuals, right? So I think that's probably what will happen with AI. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we're going to be able to vibe code a 2-hour long feature film anytime soon.
I don't know,
but
it's still about the stories and the creative telling and the human experience. And you're not going to get that from a learning language model that just imitates humans. You're just not going to get that story, that quality that people want.
Well, that's what Netflix always says, which is that, yeah, sure. Like everybody, in theory, everybody could make their own movies, but that doesn't mean they're going to be good.
No,
right.
No one wants to see the movie. No one wants to see that. So what was the last movie you saw in the theater? Do you take your kids ever go to?
I don't even know.
You don't even know. You know what? When we're kids younger, we used to take them to the movies maybe once a month or so.
Right.
When I was dating my wife, we used to go to movies all the time. Like it's really changed the movie business. And, part of it is because of Netflix, and that's, life changes, things change. I think Netflix is certainly inevitable. Anything else you want to add about Netflix?
I think just lastly on the valuation, mm-hmm. which is that before, like after they announced they were no longer buying Warner, the stocks pop a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think the valuation on Netflix was almost as cheap as it was in 22.
We've been seeing a lot of that. I mean, we talk about Constellation yeah. Software, for example. We just bought a lot more of it because it's the cheapest it's been in years.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that people often don't realize about Netflix is that they have very, very strong incremental profit growth from additional subscribers, because when you're making a show, it only costs a fixed amount.
Yeah.
And so every additional revenue that you get on top of that is just gravy.
It's just gravy. Unbelievable business. Let's switch gears and talk about another exciting business, labels right. and adhesives. And that's CCL Industries. It's a stock that probably a lot of Americans don't follow because it's only listed yep. on the TSX. It's one of these serial acquirer type businesses that's grown its business out from making labels for a lot of consumer product companies, as well as healthcare and autos, and now has become a global business. I think what's the market cap of $15 billion Canadian?
Yeah.
So it's no joke. And the company rocketed to an all-time high after reporting. The earnings were not amazingly stellar, but pretty good for CCL.
Right.
Double-digit earnings growth for the year. And I want you to talk about all the exciting things it announced and why the stock went higher.
Yeah, so we've broken down the company before on a prior podcast, so I won't kind of rehash the entire business model.
That's right.
But the basic idea of CCL is that they are a capital allocator. They look for ways to generate returns by doing deals or by returning shares of cash to shareholders through buybacks and dividends, right? Mm-hmm. And the first kind of through the 2010s, it was able to use most of its capital to do M&A at fairly attractive rates of return. Mm-hmm. Over the last couple of years, CCL hasn't really been able to do that, because there's been a lot of private equity competition in the label space.
Don't we know it? Yep. Private equity has exploded. There's more private equity firms out there than probably publicly traded yep. companies. But there's cracks right now in the system with private equity. And I think there's evidence that private equity is pulling back on yep. some investments as well, even though they may be sitting on dry powder. And could give CCL opportunities to start making aggressive acquisitions again.
Yeah, so 2025 was a very light year of acquisitions for CCL. I think they did one or two small, very, very small tuck-ins. Mm-hmm. But finally, and they get asked this every quarter, are you going to do more deals? And they said, well, we'll see what happens, right? And so finally, they started to say valuations are starting to come down because private equity competitors are not doing well. Mm-hmm. And partly that's because of, like, you know, the weak environment overall for consumer goods.
Yeah. But here's the thing that everybody misses about private equity versus a great operator. I don't think CCL has made too many mistakes with its acquisitions.
No.
Whereas if you look at private equity acquisitions of label makers or adhesives or those kind of things, there's lots of examples where private equity came in and bought and blew up the business.
Right.
And became a zero. Right? Where that's never happened with CCL. Even their Innovia acquisition, which hasn't shot the lights out, is still generating a double-digit return IRR on its initial investment.
No, and that's yeah. interesting, because I actually had talked to their executives about this exact topic. Mm-hmm. And I said, why is it so hard for private equity to, like, why are they doing so poorly in the label space?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't seem like rocket science to me. It's just, you're just basically a sticker that you print and like put onto
yeah.
stuff, right? And they said, well, like, yeah, like certainly labels, and that's the thing about labels, which is that, and this is their words, not mine, yeah. labels are kind of deceptively complex business where you really are solving a problem on behalf of the customer.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about making labels for, let's say, and this is a real business that CCL has, labels for the drug industry. So they make a lot of the, you know, when you buy Tylenol and there's like a flap that like you open up and it tells you you can take no more than two pills a day or something like that. These are kind of very regulated products. You can't get it wrong. And you have to really design it in a way that matches the customer's specifications. And it's kind of this deep intimacy with the customer that private equity doesn't have. Mm-hmm. They really don't understand what they're doing. They view it as a sticker business.
And customers are always changing their designs, the sizes, there may be mandated regulatory things, different languages. It's a complicated business, but getting down to the brass tacks of it is, you know, you have these private equity companies that may be buying for financial reasons, right? We're buying it at 8x earnings and we'll sell it to the for 12x earnings, whereas CCL is like, we'll pay less, but your business will be around because we're going to run it properly.
Right.
Yeah.
And so on the call, they said all of their private equity, not some, all of their private equity roll-up competitors are struggling.
Wow.
And so that's great for CCL because number one, it lowers the valuations on deals that they're looking for. And number two, they're actually gaining customers because of the mismanagement of the private equity competitors.
Very, very interesting. And so in the same time, CCL's balance sheet has improved tremendously because it's been slower making deals.
Yep.
So now it announced a aggressive share buyback as well as a large dividend increase, right?
Yep. So they kind of have too much cash than they know what to do with. Mm-hmm. They want to be disciplined with deals, but like then kind of the balance sheet is slowly kind of piling up with cash. Mm-hmm. So what do they do? They're buying back stock. Yeah. And that's kind of what they've largely been doing over the last year or two, where they've bought back quite a bit of stock. They created what's called an automatic share purchase plan, where they're going to be in the market every day to buy back whatever amount of stock that they can. Mm-hmm. And I think that was probably why the market reacted positively to the stock.
And in the meantime, there's always a potential for it to make a material acquisition. And you know, if that works out well, that could be significant upside for the stock. It's certainly been in the past.
Right.
Anything else to add? I think what we'll do is next episode, we'll get to the new CEO at Berkshire Hathaway. Yep. We're just digesting the new letter by Greg Abel. The results from Berkshire Hathaway, a little tougher on the insurance side for the quarter, but you can't learn anything from insurance or writing quarter to quarter. You have to look at it over a multi-year period. Greg Abel did mention that there's some challenges in the business in terms of insurance, but also countering the naysayers saying this hundreds of billions of dollars that we have, we're ready to deploy it. It's not like we're sitting there timing the market. We're just looking at deals and I really like that. And of course, the letter focuses on more operational skills that Abel has versus, you know, the folksy letter of picking stocks that Buffett used to write.
Right.
Any other quick insights you got from the letter before we digest it another time?
No, I think it was, what's interesting about a company like Berkshire when you're succeeding Warren Buffett is that you both want to establish that you're not Buffett, but also you are kind of like Buffett, and preserving the culture and the company and the philosophy that he built, right? And so kind of balancing those two things is, I think, really what I took away from that letter.
There'll never be another Warren Buffett, but that doesn't mean that Berkshire Hathaway can't make you a ton of money going forward.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to buy Bitcoin anytime soon.
No chance with that. But maybe Berkshire should look at CCL Industries.
You're right.
Good business. So with that, we'll see you back here real soon. Thank you so much for joining us today. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.